Young, it's here and now. Palestinian officials say they've secured promises of an undeclared ceasefire from militant groups. But those groups say they now expect Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas to get some promises from the Israeli government in return if the ceasefire is to hold. Joining us from Jerusalem is Harvey Morris. He's correspondent there for the Financial Times. And Harvey, before we get to the question of this ceasefire and whether it'll hold, how have things been in the region? Have they been quiet?
It's been extremely quiet now since, I would say, last Wednesday, when Mahmoud Abbas had his first round of talks with the Hamas organization. And really, since then, the sort of rocket attacks and mortar attacks that had become increasingly frequent in recent weeks subsided. And apart from a few bits of friction, I mean, there's virtually been nothing in the last week.
And we understand that 3,000 Palestinian policemen are patrolling parts of the Gaza-Israeli border to keep militants from firing into Israel proper.
It's a bit difficult to put an exact number. I think 3,000 may be a little bit exaggerated. It tends to be on the level of, you know, a few checkpoints here and there. And there's no feeling that these guys are actually out there hunting down militants or making any very proactive effort to end the violence. It's clear that there's been some sort of agreement that the militants are going to lay off, and so there hasn't been any of the feared friction between the Palestinian security forces and the militias.
Yeah, and we understand Mahmoud Abbas has been in Gaza for several days. He's extended his stay today. Tell us about these negotiations between the Palestinian Authority and the militant groups.
Well, originally, he was going to have a series of meetings with groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who've been responsible for most of the attacks on Israeli targets. In fact, he had one long three-hour meeting with Hamas and a similar meeting the following day last week with Islamic Jihad. And these groups appear to have gone away to think about it. There haven't been any further face-to-face discussions, as far as we know, certainly nothing that's been made public. Since then, however, things have calmed down, and it's quite clear that although there's no official ceasefire, that there is definitely something undeclared. There is a period of calm.
And what's your sense of how both sides, and by that I mean Israel and Hamas, are viewing Abbas?
Well, the Hamas people are being very conciliatory towards him, and they say that they feel that he has got the interests of Palestinian unity at heart, and they're taking him seriously, and they want to do what they can to put a unified front on the Palestinian case. The Israelis, meanwhile, are saying, yes, he's an honest man. He's doing what he can to bring calm. This is not the solution they wanted. They rather wanted him to send in his troops to crack down on the militants. He decided not to do that. Nevertheless, there have been some kind words from Israel. However, Israeli officials are saying, without too much public evidence at the moment that they're prepared to give us, that Iran and the Hezbollah group in Lebanon are attempting to stir up trouble in the territories and to try and break the ceasefire.
Well, staying, though, with Israel and the militants, what are the quid pro quos on either side? What are the militants demanding from Abbas in return for a halt to attacks? What are they demanding from Israel?
I think the militants aren't in a very strong position to make too many demands. After all, Hamas, in particular, has suffered quite heavily in the last year through Israeli assassinations of their leadership. They've been declared a terrorist organization, you know, in Europe and in the States long, long ago. So they're suffering financially by a freeze on their assets. And it's quite clear that people, particularly in Gaza, are becoming very weary of the violence and the retaliation from Israel. And there's a real feeling that people want a period of peace and quiet. And I think that Hamas and the others have had to respond to that.
I was going to say,
they may lose politically.
Well, I was going to say, do you have any sense that they realize this? Hamas meeting?
No, I think they do. I think they do. I mean, I know Hamas, we obviously tend to regard it, or it's regarded widely in the world as a terrorist organisation because of the operations it's mounted against Israel. But it's not an entirely irrational organisation. It does have political interests. And I think they've come to realise that the strategy of mounting attacks on Israel and inviting retaliation was not increasing its popularity. Let's put it that way.
Harvey Morris, we've got 30 seconds left. American Mideast envoy William Burns expected to arrive in 2 days to the region. Do you see momentum building towards something more comprehensive?
Well, I think that what the Palestinians certainly would like would be American intervention, diplomatic intervention on a large scale to see this present quiet, if it should survive, turn into final status talks between the two sides. The Ariel Sharon government are not very willing to see that. They would like to see an interim solution. They'd like to see peace and quiet, but they want to delay any final status negotiations for as long as they can.
Harvey Morris, correspondent for the Financial Times, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Harvey, thank you.
Thank you.
Two new medical studies are leading doctors to re-examine the way they diagnose and treat heart disease, which affects about 5 million Americans. For years, doctors have tested cholesterol levels to determine the health of a person's heart. But the New England Journal of Medicine reports this month that something known as the C-reactive protein may be a better way to predict the risk of a heart attack. The protein measures inflammation in artery walls, which could be treated with drugs. Well, this news prompted us to take a look at the latest advances in treating people with heart disease. Our first guest is Bill Wall. He lived with a CardioWest total artificial heart for 159 days while waiting for the donor heart that he now lives with. That technology kept Bill alive to become the first ever artificial heart to gain, and the CardioWest became the first ever artificial heart to gain FDA approval last year. Well, joining us to talk about life with an artificial heart, first of all, Bill Wall of Scottsdale, Arizona. Hello.
Hello.
And we also are joined by Dr. Marvin Slepian. He's CEO of Syncardia, which makes CardioWest, and he's also a cardiologist at the University of Arizona. Doctor, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
And stand by there for a second, because, Bill, I want to ask you first. We understand that this artificial heart is attached to a big machine. What was that like to live with that for 159 days?
Well, I came out of a coma after a month, and when I woke up, it took a while adapting to being attached to something, plugged into the wall and getting around with an entourage, because you weren't able to just go anywhere you wanted on your own.
You were
very well monitored.
I understand you had both an engineer and a nurse with you at all times?
Yeah, and usually several IV poles, because I was a pretty sick puppy at the time.
Yeah, you had a massive heart attack. Now, we understand that this machine itself that makes the artificial heart work is huge. I mean, how big is it?
It's about 400 pounds on wheels. At one time in the hospital, we had about 8 people on the CardioWest, and we were kind of called the washing machine squad, because it was like we were wheeling around big 400-pound washing machines on wheels with a computer on top wherever we went.
Well, Dr. Slepian, now we have this image in our minds of these people attached to huge, well, washing machines that are keeping these artificial hearts alive. It sounds awfully expensive. How much does it cost?
This type of device right now is slated to be sold for about $100,000. The reality is, if you compare this to other technologies that exist today, such as ventricular assist devices, which sell for nearly that price, this actually is cheap and inexpensive compared to the massive amount that's spent for all these accessory devices that are used often for failing patients.
We're going to be talking more about other developments for the heart, but the ventricular devices keep blood flowing to a certain portion of the heart.
Right. Basically, this whole field stems from a disease called congestive heart failure, which is the final common pathway of any kind of heart disease, whether your arteries are bad, your valves are bad, the rhythm is bad. At the end of the day, when the heart really starts to have the impact of that, the pump doesn't work, and that's called congestive heart failure. There are 5 million patients in America with congestive heart failure alone, and this end-stage heart failure, there's about 100,000 patients with what we call class 4 heart failure. Unfortunately, for those patients, only about 2,000 patients a year get a transplant. And even those 2,000 that do, there are about 8,000 that are eligible, and about 20% of those patients die waiting on a waiting list. And it's exactly for that group that this technology has been developed, to act as a parachute to catch the patient before they fall to a non-recoverable state and die, to save their life, stabilizing them, and in fact allowing them, their body, to recover so that when a transplant is placed into them, the transplant takes and they actually do much, much better.
Dr. Slepian, you helped create it. Can you explain how the CardioWest heart works?
The device is basically a pneumatic device. That means that this is driven by air. So there, imagine the heart, each, your heart is made up of four chambers, the normal heart. The top two atria are little inflow areas, but really the heart is the two bottom ventricles. That's the business end, the pumping chambers. So the artificial heart is mimics that, and there are two large pumping chambers, which really, imagine, they're like a sphere or an ellipse. And one wall of that ellipse is made up of a membrane, and that membrane on the other side of it has air, and on the inside, the blood comes. So it's like a bellows. It moves in and out, in and out, in and out as the air drives this. So there's no blood going outside of the patient's body or anything like that. Everything is contained in the patient. The little exit is of a drive line that simply moves air. So it's a very simple type of system, and it's very, very reliable.
And so, doctor, tell me, was Bill's diseased heart removed and the artificial heart put in, or do they work
Absolutely.
Alongside? Yeah, it was completely removed. So, Bill, what did that feel like?
It was different adapting to. You had to go with the entourage everywhere. I was very lucky that in lieu of sitting in the sun, they began taking me to the gym, and I returned to my days as a gym rat. And
with the machine?
Correct. They used to plug me into the ceiling, and people in there weren't sure if it was a heart and lung machine or what it was, but they gave me a wide berth, and it got to the point where every day they took me down to the cardiac rehab gym at University Medical Center, and I got my workout in.
Could you feel the artificial heart pumping as you would feel your own heart, or did you just feel a mass in your chest? What did it feel like?
Well, you heard it, because I remember they had set me at 150 beats a minute, so I was racing 24 hours a day. What you could feel was there were two tubes that were coming out of your chest that were moving the blood in and out of your prosthetic left and right ventricle, and you had to be very careful about infection, and you could certainly know that those tubes were there, and you had to be careful whatever you did.
Bill Wahl was the first recipient of an FDA-approved artificial heart. When we come back, we'll learn more about what it feels like to live with an artificial heart. And we'll also continue our conversation with Dr. Marvin Slepian. He's CEO of Syncardia, which produces the CardioWest artificial heart. We'll ask what he sees in the future. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today we've been talking about the CardioWest artificial heart. Now, the CardioWest is a direct descendant of famed heart surgeon Dr. Jarvik's Jarvik 7, which was implanted in two men in the early 80s. They each lived for days and months with the device before dying. The FDA ultimately shut down those human experiments. CardioWest has had more success. Patients who use it are tethered to a 400-pound pumping machine. They're observed by an engineer and nurse. CardioWest has some side effects, the most serious being being blood clots and infections, but it's enabled a significant number of patients to live longer than patients without the artificial heart and thus receive a healthy donor heart. CardioWest is also the only FDA-approved total artificial heart. Another heart, AbioCar Heart, is in the FDA approval pipeline. It's powered by an energy system that sends electricity through the skin, and that helps avoid infection since there's no incision for a power supply cable. And the AbioCar Heart also has a small computer and battery pack attached to it so the patient can be free from an external power supply. But as we said, the AbioCar has not been approved yet. Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Marvin Slepian. He's CEO of Syncardia, which produces the CardioWest artificial heart. He's been speaking to us from a heart convention in Tampa, Florida today. And we're also talking to Bill Wall. He lived with a CardioWest for 159 days while waiting for the donor heart that he now lives with. And Bill, tell us more about what it was like living with an artificial heart.
Well, in a nutshell, it saved my life and gave me a second chance. And that's some of the big thing with my foundation these days. We're trying to get the opportunity for more people to have a second chance, for more people to know that their lives can be saved and changed. And also, there are a lot of regular people that I'm tickled to inspire to get off their butts and start working out again. Because quite often, thank God the doctors that I know, Dr. Slepian and Copeland, we enjoy riding bikes and racing together, but there are an awful lot of doctors and business people. They just get caught up in the sedentary life of being business successful, and it's killing America.
Dr. Slepian, Bill Wall is one of your success stories. 280 CardioWest hearts have been implanted for these patients who need a bridge between a heart failure and a heart donor. How successful has it been relative to people who don't have the CardioWest?
Well, I mean, in our study, which we published this summer in the New England Journal, we had a rate of survival to transplantation was 79%. And in a cohort of control patients that did not receive the therapy, their survival was only about 45-46%.
Does insurance cover this?
This is covered by select insurance companies, but we want to make this universally available under the Medicare system, and that's our challenge for this year. I don't anticipate major issues, but we still have to go through all of the governmental paperwork.
Well, Dr. Slepian, as you well know, I mean, you know, it sounds miraculous, and you have Bill Wall standing there, who's now, you know, a participant in the U.S. transplant games. I didn't even know there was such a thing, and a spokesperson for Better Health. Can the health system, which can barely afford to cover, you know, just average health care for many Americans, afford this, you know, hugely expensive process?
Well, I think that, you know, you have to look at it as a from a slightly different perspective. Let's go back to the target group. Right now, this is used as a bridge to transplantation, and you may say that that's a very unique small group of patients that get wind up getting a transplant. But the bigger group that this could address are the 100,000 patients that have end-stage congestive heart failure. And for 98,000 of those patients right now, they die. Now, you might say that half of them may be too old and have other diseases and morbidities, so they may just be beyond salvage. But there's probably about 50,000 patients that right now are repetitively being admitted to the hospital with recurrent congestive heart failure, and their cost to the healthcare system is astronomical. If you could implant a system like that in these patients, the one-time cost of the implantation and the cost of the device, the maintenance of this, once you could discharge a patient from the hospital, which will be possible with newer drivers that are here and now and we're working with in Europe and soon to come to the United States, and they'll take a year or so to go through FDA approval process, would create a whole new scenario for really end-stage heart failure patients. So I think that while there may be some upfront cost, in the big picture, this may actually be cost savings for a very large group of patients that have advanced heart disease.
Well, Dr. Slepian, what is the future of the CardioWest heart?
The vision was to make this a permanent device. So it has the durability engineered into it. And we've had patients in France on this for over 3.5 years. So, you know, it's conceivable someone could have this put in. It could go for 5 years, and we could even mandate that at 5 years they have it changed, and they could have it for another 5 years. And if you give someone 5 or 10 years of life, I mean, we get excited when the chemotherapeutic drug for cancer buys you 4 months. It's big news.
Dr. Marvin Slepian is CEO of Syncardia, which makes the CardioWest artificial heart. He's also a cardiologist at the University of Arizona. We also spoke with Bill Wall of Scottsdale, Arizona. He lived with the artificial heart for 159 days until he received a donor heart. Thank you both for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And this note, David Nyan, a columnist for the Boston Globe for 3 decades, a contributor to Here and Now, and a giant of a man in many ways, died yesterday of an apparent heart attack while shoveling snow. Boston was hit by one of the worst blizzards in the city's history, and doctors caution every winter that the combination of severe cold and strenuous shoveling can be fatal. But still, David's death is inconceivable to his many friends and fans. David was a former Harvard linebacker, a competitive basketball player, and a ferocious commentator who wore his liberalism on his sleeve, yet also backed the Republican candidates he admired. At 6'4", he was a formidable presence whose political passions were only matched by his deep love of people. Next month, he was scheduled to travel to Sri Lanka with a foundation he helped form that sends doctors to troubled regions of the world. David Nyan died yesterday at the age of 64, and it's hard for those who knew him to reconcile that the heart that was so generous to others failed him. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Washington Post story was gripping. A 41-year-old woman from a well-to-do Iraqi family was brutalized by Saddam Hussein's soldiers because she married an Indian. And unlike most who suffered at the hands of the Ba'athist regime, she was willing to name names. 9 Iraqi officers were arrested on her word, and U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz applauded her courage in testimony in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Then she was relocated to California, all expenses paid. Her story was gripping, but it wasn't true. Sarah Solovich, a reporter for Esquire magazine, received a book contract to write the story of Jumana Hana. What she learned appears in this month's issue of the magazine. And Sarah Solovich recalls her reaction to Hana's story as it was originally reported.
When I first read her story in the Washington Post, I was so moved. I couldn't imagine that anybody would not think about writing it and taking this project on.
Yeah. And here were some of the things she alleged, that she and other female prisoners were dragged outside a prison in Baghdad and tied to a dead tree trunk where they were raped in the shadow of palm trees. Electric shock was applied to her vagina. Her husband was shot in the head and then handed to her like a piece of butcher's meat. And it goes on. You know, that's only a small portion of it. And people did try to sort of suss out what she said, right?
Yes. In fact, it was Bernard Carrick, who was then senior policy advisor to the Interior Ministry in Iraq, who assigned 2 full-time military investigators to look into her story. And they spent 4 months investigating them.
Right. So we're now
completely confirmed everything that she said.
Even though they couldn't find and dig up the bodies that she said were buried at the prison where she was, others, doctors, for instance, said sonograms showed that she wasn't raped, but that she had early menopause. There was some hint that possibly all was not well.
The sonogram wasn't done until she arrived in California, but she was also examined by a very prominent Iraqi gynecologist, someone who was well respected by authorities in Baghdad, American authorities. And those Americans spoke very highly of this man and were shocked when he more or less denounced her as a liar. Mm. But the military investigators, these two young men who were in the National Guard, the ones who'd been assigned to investigate her, just dismissed him as essentially an incompetent, a third world incompetent.
And the coalition authority embraced her. She moved into the compound, the safe green zone, for a while before she moved to the U.S. Paul Bremer's assistants, helped to babysit for her children and have them go to sleep at night. So there was a whole cottage industry forming around Jumana Ahana. When did you really have that, cold feeling in your veins that, oh my gosh, I don't know that this is true?
There were so many times that, you just have that gut instinct. And I have to say, I ignored it on many occasions. Well, when I first met her, which was last August, one of the things that bothered me the most was her claim that she had gone to Oxford University and had graduated with a master's degree, but her English was really very rudimentary. And her written English was atrocious. So I really had some questions, wondering how she could have gone to Oxford. But I ignored that and other things she said partly because the Washington Post had, credited her story with a large front page piece about it, but also because so many of the people I talked to really believed her. And it wasn't until she told me that a man in the Chronicle, who had been written about in the San Francisco Chronicle, had been one of her guards. And she seized upon this and wanted to go to the DA's office in San Francisco and have this man arrested as somebody who shouldn't have been allowed to enter the U.S. because he was a former torturer. I started at that point looking into it and really trying to pin down everything she said. And at that point, it all imploded.
It all imploded. When she heard that you found out that she didn't go to Oxford, she became very angry, trashed her apartment in front of you, eventually broke off all contact?
Yes, for a few weeks. And then she called me back and told me that she couldn't, how could I think that she was angry? She would call me her candle, her voice. She was a very convincing person and also a very warm person, and she really laid it on. But she called me back, and we met again. And at that point, she admitted numerous things, including that she hadn't been jailed for the reasons that she had initially told the Post or the military investigators. At that point, I knew that I had already checked that out. But in fact, she had been jailed because she was a prostitute. And her mother was the one who had arranged to have her jailed.
Well, people like white supremacist David Duke are now using Hannah's lies to support his theory that people lied about what happened in the Holocaust. But online blogs still adore her. One says she alone is justification for President Bush's Operation Iraqi Freedom. She had become a symbol for neocons like Paul Wolfowitz.
The real significance of it is that her story was seized upon by the administration largely because it served their agenda, which he wanted fit very neatly into exactly what they wanted. As a former prostitute, I think she's really adept at, seizing people up, imagining what their fantasies are, and then trying to fulfill those fantasies.
And the same kind of person will surface in just about any society. But in this case, is Jumana's story, the fact that she turned out to be fabricating, is that going to obscure, real abuses of human rights perpetrated by Saddam Hussein's regime?
Yeah, I think that's what's so really damaging and nasty about it, is that she just capitalized on the truth, but did it in a way that, you know, was a total lie.
What's going to happen to Jemana now? Will she be sent back?
No. In fact, she's left the state. Apparently, she's, you know, has asylum and will be allowed to stay as, you know, as long as she wants.
Sarah Salovich, A Cautionary Tale. She tells it in The American Dream, her article that appears in this month's issue of Esquire magazine. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this postscript. Late last week, The Washington Post acknowledged that Jemana Hanna lied about her past. An editor for The Post said it was a mistake not to include a disclaimer with the original article, saying that the paper had not been able to independently verify Hanna's allegations. And this note about Iraq. Authorities there have announced the arrest of a man believed to be linked to the attack on United Nations headquarters in Baghdad 2 years ago, an attack that killed 22 people and led to the UN withdrawing its observers from the country. That man was arrested January 15th and, according to a government statement, confessed to building most of the car bombs used in Baghdad over the past 2 years. The statement identifies the suspect as a top lieutenant to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, many investors were hoping for a better start than this. The Dow Jones Industrials and the S&P 500 have both been down since the first of the year. That's three straight weeks, and that hasn't happened since 1977. And although the U.S. markets opened higher today, investors still have the January jitters. Here now is financial reporter Mark Mills joins us now in the studio to look at Wall Street's wobbly start in 2005. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Robin.
And you tell me, January is usually one of the strongest months of the year, so what happened?
Well, we're getting the reverse January effect. There's something called the January effect, where January often is a good month because you've got people who've gotten year-end bonuses that they invest, people making new retirement investments, or people who've sold stocks in the latter part of the year before reinvesting that money. And all that demand generally gives us a strong January, but we are having a flopper of one so far.
And what's the biggest impact? I mean, there's year-end bonuses that usually adds to the big January, doesn't it?
Yeah, those things tend to give a rise to the stock market. But despite those things, we are seeing a negative start to the year. We have as of Friday's close, the Dow and the S&P 500 down 3.6% year-to-date. The NASDAQ, the tech's down 6.5%. So we are getting off to a bad start.
And what are some of the factors that are worrying investors? Why the decline?
Well, there's always something to worry about. But right now, people are focusing on oil prices getting higher again after that big spike above $50 late last year. It came back down. Now we're seeing it rise again. The Iraqi election is just days away, and there has been a lot of violence in advance of that. People worry about more of that, maybe some of it disrupting the flow of oil if there's an attack on the oil fields. And the Federal Reserve will be meeting next week, and they are expected to continue raising interest rates, which can be a problem for the market. And you also have some people investing overseas, Robin, who might normally invest in the U.S. and feeling that maybe there's some better opportunities overseas. So that kind of drains some money out of the system.
Hmm. Well, this week, 150 companies in the S&P 500 are going to be announcing their fourth quarter results. It's one of the biggest weeks of the year for people like you who love this. And for others who watch it, what are some of the companies you'll be looking at?
Well, the earnings are very important. They really give an insight into how companies are doing. And this is a big week for fourth quarter earnings. DuPont, Johnson & Johnson, SBC Communications, Microsoft, McDonald's. As you say, about 150 big companies crossing many different industries. So there'll be a lot for the market to digest.
And how are the announcements already affecting the markets? How will they affect the markets?
So far, the announcements that are coming in are okay in general. We have earnings growth of 16% compared to the fourth quarter of a year ago is expected when all of the earnings are said and done, which is a very good rate of return normally. But the rate of earnings growth is slowing, and that's affecting the market. The last four quarters before this one, we had better than 20% growth compared to the year before. Mm-hmm. So we're in a decelerating phase of earnings growth, and that can spook the market a little bit.
And by the way, we only have a couple minutes left. I don't want to get you off track, but I always do. What does this tell you? Are companies feeling healthier than maybe people are?
I think a lot of companies are feeling healthier than people are. The earnings, we've had a very strong earnings rebound from the recession of 2001. We have not had a powerful jobs and income rebound for a lot of individuals. So this is a better boardroom recovery than kitchen table recovery.
Right. And what about the state of the underlying economy? You know, does Wall Street think the economy may start to sputter? How does it get read?
Well, the backdrop on the economy is pretty good overall. It's just that there are some big issues lurking in the background that could come out and cause trouble at any time. At the end of this week, we're going to get the report on gross domestic product. That's economic growth for the fourth quarter, and analysts expect that to come in at about 3.5%, which is a good rate of growth. It's a little slower than the third quarter, where we had 4% growth rate. Inflation continues to be tame, although these higher oil prices are a threat to consumer spending. And the federal budget deficit and those trade deficit numbers that keep coming out are growing concerns, and they're leading to a weaker dollar. So there are some skeletons rattling in the closet, but nothing that's immediate and dramatic.
Well, meantime, a few seconds left. Many personal advisors say this actually may be the best time to invest. In what? Why?
Well, when the markets are down, often people get scared and they start selling, and in fact, that may present buying opportunities. But I will say that for most investors, Robin, it's better not to try to time the market and jump in and out based on hunches and
right.
your emotions, but have a good investment plan and stick with it.
Because we saw a few years ago how well that worked.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that one.
Here now is financial reporter Mark Mills. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Blitzkrieg Bop by the Ramones, just one of the many bands featured on the 4-CD box set No Thanks, the 70s Punk Rebellion. The set has been nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Liner Notes. Chris Morris wrote those notes, and I asked him recently what led to this rebellious music we now call punk.
Before things really started exploding in New York in the mid-70s, there were acts like the Stooges in Detroit, the New York Dolls in New York, the Dictators. These were all bands that played music that was loud, it was simple, it was fast, in some cases it was kind of dumb, it was very pared down, and these were the models. But it wasn't until things really got established in the New York club that things really took off. I must keep walking cheetah with a hat full of name pound. I'm a runaway son of the nuclear age band. I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. Honey, gotta help me, please. Somebody gotta save my soul. Baby, destiny for me. Oh. Iggy and the Stooges performing Search and Destroy. Chris, tell us about the people, you know, who created this new form of music. These were disaffected people and disenfranchised people. The groups in New York, which is really ground zero for the music that's surveyed on the box set, they needed a place to play. They found a place to play at CBGB's. The bands didn't sound alike, but they became part of a very loosely knit community of people that wanted to make their own music, couldn't get record deals, and they found a home.
Of course, rebellious women found a home in this community as well. I'm thinking of Patti Smith, for example.
Every night before I go to sleep, find a ticket, win a lottery, scoop the pearls up from the sea.
Well, consider what was selling back in the 70s, Olivia Newton-John. These were women that had a point of view and an attitude. Patti Smith, Debbie Harry from Blondie, later on Chrissy Hynde from The Pretenders. These were tough gals, and there really wasn't a place for them in the commercial mainstream.
They're stolen, but I don't feel bad. I take that money, buy you things you never had. Oh, baby, it would mean so much to me.
Punk, known for its do-it-yourself aspect, could they play guitar? Could these musicians play?
Well, some of them couldn't, but some of them could. You go back and listen to a band like the Buzzcocks. That's a great pop band.
I can't see much of the future unless we find out what's to blame for the shame. And we won't be together much longer unless we realize that we are the same.
Of course, they have spawned, I think, a whole genre of contemporary musicians. Green Day, which was nominated for a Grammy for Album of the Year for American Idiot, they would not have been able to exist without the example of the Buzzcocks, which was a highly, highly competent writing machine.
You mentioned Green Day as being one of the offsprings of early punk, and I'm thinking of some of Green Day's hits, which were actually written in more punk style, and then made more palatable for a mainstream audience by the time they got to radio. What happened to punk? Did radio kill punk too?
Well, radio wasn't really interested in punk in its first incarnation. Neither were the American record labels. For the most part, it wasn't until later on when the music was rediscovered and recycled that it really became part of the mainstream. Since Nirvana came into the picture in the early 90s, I think there's been more and more absorption of the punk sound, if not necessarily the punk ideal. Green Day, Good Charlotte, Simple Plan. These are acts that are deriving their sound and their visual style from the music, but it's easy in some cases to wonder how legitimately concerned they are with anything besides making money. I think that there was a worldview and an emotional and political aspect to the original punk music that has kind of been brushed to the side. I think a lot of it is simply the assumption of style today.
Well, let's listen to a little of Green Day. This from their new CD. They call it a punk rock opera, American Idiot.
Welcome to a new kind of tension all across the alien mission. Everything is meant to be okay. Television dreams of tomorrow. We're not the ones who meant to follow. But that's enough to work you.
Chris Morris has been nominated for a Grammy for his liner notes on the companion booklet to the 4-CD box set called No Thanks, the 70s Punk Rebellion. He's been speaking to us from Los Angeles. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dreams of tomorrow. Where
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our newscast producer is Matt Largy, and our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin.